Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 21st, 2006. Today's session is entitled The Holden Mine Site History, Mining Techniques, and Environmental Studies, presented by Don Coberly. Let's listen in.
For just a minute, about the idea of plate tectonics, which is in the time I have been studying geology since 1977, this is the unifying theory of geology, where geology prior had there were things that happened out in the world, things that we saw but we couldn't explain. And then due to a number of scientific breakthroughs, we had sort of this revolution. This is very much in geology like quantum mechanics was to physics. It was just a whole new way to look at things. The essence of it is the Earth is hot in the middle and cold at the outside. Make sense? Radioactivity inside, rocks are continuing to radioactively decay, heat is generated. Because rock is a good insulator, that heat gets trapped. Out on the surface, we have the environment around us, which today is 55 degrees Fahrenheit, and some days here is minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. That's way cooler than the 850 degrees that the rocks are at some depth. When you have something that's hot in one place and cold in another, the heat gets transferred. What we think happens in the mantle, which is the intermediate part of the Earth, which is viscous, so it's thick but flowy, is these big convection cells form in that material and work like big conveyor belts. And so the continents that we see, even though they may be 12 or 15 miles thick, in relation to the rest of the Earth, think about the skin on an apple. That's the thickness you should be thinking about. This stuff that we're standing on right now is the skin of the apple. It's more like an eggshell that's been broken into pieces, and those pieces float around on this really viscous stuff, and over geologic time, bump into each other. And when they bump into each other, it depends on what the two things are that bump into each other as to what happens in the geology. If the things that bump into each other are both continental crust, that's India being jammed into Southern Asia. You get two big blocks of stuff, and this is being pushed, and this is holding back, and what happens is that compression forces up the mountains that we now call the Himalayas. There are two main types of crust. Oceanic crust is the stuff that we see under the oceans, and then continental crust, which is the stuff we're standing on right now. That Himalayan collision is continental crust and continental crust. It bangs into each other, and both of them are thick enough that they just ram into each other and pretty much move upward, buckle up, until that energy gets dissipated. Oceanic crust is much thinner, and it's also denser than continental crust, so when oceanic crust butts up against continental crust, the oceanic crust gets what we call subducted. It gets pushed under, it gets pushed down. As it goes down, it gets hotter. As it gets hotter, it starts to melt. As it starts to melt, part of it bubbles off and comes up and becomes intrusions. This is South America. This is a schematic of South America. This also holds in North America, to where these mountains that are whatever these are in South America, in North America, they're the Sierra Nevada of California and the Cascades of Oregon and Washington. And that granite, or that intrusive rock that we see, I1 and I2, is stuff just like this that came up to some few miles below the surface, cooled there, and then through this continued compression, this whole block gets pushed up, stuff gets eroded off the top, and now we get to be able to see I1 and I2, or we get to be able to see Half Dome and El Capitan. When oceanic crust runs into oceanic crust, that's another, right? You have two possibilities. You have oceanic and continental. So you have four different possibilities: continental against continental, oceanic against oceanic, and oceanic against continental. I guess you have three possibilities. When oceanic runs into oceanic, it one, for some reason, flexes more than the other, and one starts to subduct, and you get islands like Indonesia or Japan or New Zealand that have these volcanoes at the core. The volcanoes build up, get stuff out into the environment. The environment wants to wear everything down. The environment wears so now there's a battle going on here between, will the volcanoes build faster than the environment will erode away? And that erosion takes place and sediment gets deposited and gets lithified. Now, if we combine these two, we've got to flip this one over first, but it's still exactly the same process. And we kind of made it up like this. We have precisely the situation that was happening here 110 million years ago. Everything to the east of us was the United States at the time, 100 million years ago, to be nationalistic. Sorry. It was North America, excuse me. 200 million years ago, the edge of the North American plate was somewhere like the Idaho-Montana border. And the history of the last 200 million years is these islands, these Indonesian or Japan or, not Korea, Indonesia, Japan, New Zealand gets pushed in, pushed, smashed onto the continent. And there's another one coming right behind it. And it gets banged onto the back. And this thing in here gets all mashed up from the next two or three or four things that get bumped on behind it. So let's look at our cheat sheet that I passed out. And the one thing you need to do on this cheat sheet is...
Is there any left?
Well, of course there are. What you need to do on your cheat sheet is switch I1 and I2 so that it makes sense from everything we said yesterday. Yep. So, and this is a proprietary drawing program. Bill Gates doesn't have this yet. So, the top panel is my cartoon version of what we just saw. The middle panel is what was happening in the Holden Village area about 110 million years ago. There was an Indonesian-style island, and sediment was being shed off that island. And when you look on the back side, those are the sediments that in time will become M1. That's the sedimentary part of it. This Indonesian island gets pushed into, and as that Indonesian island is getting pushed closer to the west coast of the United States, the plate is subducting over at the east side. And what's not shown there is there might be a little bit of intrusion, some melting of the plate. There is melting of the plate behind the island that we're on, farther to the west, which is starting to be intrusion that we call I1, Harley's Rock. That whole package gets rammed onto the west coast of the North American continent, excuse me, by the following stuff behind it, and that's everything to the west of us. And I don't know how many more episodes of stuff getting accrete, A-C-C-R-E-T-E. That's the term that we use. That's the technical term for getting bashed on. I don't know how many more of those there are between us and the coast. The last one is the one that the Olympic Peninsula sits on.
What is it still? It's still happening then, huh?
It's happening every day. And just happening, the rate of plate movements is about the rate of the growth of your fingernail. That's a good analogy to think of. So
relative, the growth of our fingernail relative to our body then?
No, in time. So that you're, if you didn't cut your fingernail for a year, your fingernail would be 2.5 inches long. A plate moves at about 2.5 inches a year. So we don't notice it. We notice it when it's the San Andreas Fault. And we notice it if we live for 500 million years at 2.5 inches a year. Now.
Is that Mount St. Helens? Is that why that's erupting?
Mount St. Helens would be related to the subduction of the plate and the remelting of it and that material, that molten material, coming up and getting close to surface. What plate tectonics does, why it's such a holistic theory, why it's such an encompassing theory, is it takes all of the observations that we make in geology. A volcano is an observation. An earthquake is an observation. Where are the faults? Well, here's a fault here. Where are the volcanoes? What's this? How are they distributed? Why are there not big volcanoes in Nebraska? Well, because that's kind of in the middle of the plate. It's not near the edges where things happen to be going on. So it's a very comprehensive theory, and it seems to, in the moment, explain most of the things we see.
And when is this theory promulgated?
Sorry?
When was the theory of plate tectonics promulgated?
Since 1968.
Really?
Yes.
It's a law, not a theory, right?
No, it's a theory.
Still a theory?
It's still, Let me get on my soapbox about that in a second.
Why do you know more about the St. Andreas Fault and not about the others?
Why do we know more
about the St. Andreas Fault?
Oh, it's been studied very thoroughly.
Because it goes along.
Simply because of how it intersects with humans. I mean, if there's a fault out in the middle of the ocean, and when it moves, nobody, who cares? When the San Andreas Fault goes off, we hear about it. A theory, a law is, I don't know if there are any laws in science. We think of theories as being an explanation which describes the occurrences we see and fits the evidence. Gives us the ability to make new hypotheses. If plate tectonics actually holds and we see these volcanoes, that should mean that somewhere beneath there should be a plate. If we could do I don't think we can do this, but if we could do a radar study that would go down 20 miles, which we should be able to see that plate. If for some reason we are able to do that and the plate's coming up now rather than going down, we need to scratch our heads and maybe change our theory. So scientists, I trust we are subtle enough and upstanding enough to say, this is a theory. We're always collecting new evidence. I don't, who has the slide called the laws of geology? Those we're not going to fight about. This we can still talk about. All right, any other questions about this? Any other questions that came up? From
what was the immediate preceding theory in plate tectonics? Is that recent?
Oh, it was. You know, the same way Cliff doesn't like to talk about using leeches on people. He's a little bashful about that because right now we think, ooh, what was he thinking? It's kind of the same way in geology. It was the synclinal theory. Which is the mountains that we see are due to sort of the shriveling of the skin on the apple. And getting into geology in 1977, plate tectonics had gone from sort of a dream or the stuff that'd get you thrown out of the meeting to some beginning of acceptance and with that new theory, holy cow, think of all the new different things the new experiments that idea generates. And that was happening at that point. So we learned a little bit of synclinal theory, but it was the same way we were learning to bleed people and put leeches. So, all right, I'm going to pop the cover on that projector, and we can start having a talk about the mine. I'm going to kill a bunch of these lights. Is that enough or more?
Cliff, get those lights right behind you there.
Okay. It's straight on that wall, right behind that, straight back on that screen wall.
Yeah, on that wall. Too.
Yeah, that's good. Oh, beautiful. Oh, stop doing that. Okay. This is a PowerPoint presentation that I developed originally back in 2002. Is that in focus enough for people?
No. No.
Well, you had too much wine last night.
Beer.
And
I didn't even get to taste it. That's pretty sad.
Well,
you should have come.
Whoops. Better or worse?
Better. That's better.
Better or worse?
That's more better.
Okay. That's right. I got a future as an ophthalmologist, don't I? The Holden Mine Site Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, a work in progress. I chose that title very carefully, like I do sometimes, thinking of it in two ways, sort of a work in progress, like we're trying to get somewhere, and the other is it's a work in progress. We're moving along, trying to get somewhere on the geologic time scale. It's moving very slowly, as you can see. This is the sixth edition of this, and I've given the fifth edition a couple of times and the third edition a couple of times. So, here are the topics I want to cover. A brief introduction, we'll talk about the mine site, we'll talk about the environmental investigations, we'll talk about the framework of the environmental studies, the legal framework that we're working on here. This has to do with the Superfund process. Talk about the schedule to date. Those dates will seem old when we see them. Tentative schedule for the future, we'll laugh at that. The work that we've completed, talk about a brief site model. How can we, in 2 or 3 or 10 sentences rather than 1,000, describe the site? And then find out or relay to you what we have found. I have to make a disclaimer. I'm a consultant. I can't give a talk without a disclaimer. I work for the company that has the liability for the mine. I strive to be objective and independent, and yet I am imperfect at that. You should know that up front. The Forest Service, the Department of Ecology was just here. They're just leaving now. They're on the other side of the table. If they were giving a talk, it might be a little bit different. You need to know that, or I will feel better if you know that. The second point is, I can't remember what the second point was.
That's all right.
My objective here is to summarize 8 years. It's now 9 years. Perhaps 30,000 hours. It's more than that by now, of professional time by highly trained professionals or guys who got their degrees off of box tops, who have been working on this mine site since 1997, trying to help your understanding of the mine so that you can know what the environmental process or the ongoing process is. And if you want, you can become an informed participant on future decisions affecting Holden Village and the local environment. I'll get back to that idea as we move along. Okay, here are the basics of the mine. The ore body was discovered by Holden in 1887. The family story from the Holdens is that he was out shooting a deer to feed the party. He was here as part of a surveying crew for the railroad. The railroad wanted to run a rail line somewhere to get to the West Coast, and they said, well, we're going to send surveying crews out, hike up the valley, and see if we can get a railroad through there. Hence the term Railroad Creek. So he did not come here as a miner. That wasn't his background. He was part of a surveying team, and he was out shooting dinner one night, and the deer died up on the outcrop, and he saw the mineralized ground there and staked a claim. Mining by Howe Sound took place from 1938 to 1957. That was the big time, the big production days here. There was a little bit of mining done prior to that, but that was mom and pop operations. All the stuff brought in by Mule, and people made a little bit of money at that, but it was Howe Sound that built the village and built the mill building and did the majority of the mining. Copper and zinc were the primary metals of interest. There was also a little gold and silver produced. There are 60 miles of underground mine workings. 8 million tons of tailings were placed in the three tailings piles, covering approximately 90 acres. It used to be on the boat ride coming up, the Forest Service people would say that they used cyanide up here. That wasn't really true. I spoke to the mine geologist, or the geologist who knows more about the place than anybody else, and he said in the very earliest days, 38, 39, they used a little bit of cyanide, but none after that. Arsenic was not used in the mining processes here. That was another misstatement that the Forest Service liked to make on the boat. There is arsenic in some of the minerals that are found here. Okay, continuing on, and here is a little bit of a volume, a way to think of how much material was brought out. About 2,000 tons a day came out of the hill. About 200 tons a day of concentrate was made, so 90% effective, or 10% went down the road in a big tub, six tubs to a truck. The rest of it went out on the tailings piles. The concentrate, that's the rock that came out of the mine, was crushed to make it more reactive and to make it into finer particles. That material was bubbled up through flotation tanks, is what they were called, and they used a number of different chemicals or formulations, almost like tree sap. And those things were formulated to be very sticky to gold or copper or zinc, but not sticky to rock, like the igneous rock that we saw. So they would add the stuff to the bubbling tanks. They would float the good stuff off. The stuff that had no value to it would sink. They do this three or four times. The good stuff would go, that would be what was called the concentrate. And the remainder of the stuff would be slurried out to the tailings ponds and pooped out the end of a big tube. And they would build up dikes around the tailings piles with the coarser material and then just allow the rest of the stuff to flow into the middle of the tailings piles. They had a drain in the middle where the water would drain off and go into railroad creek. The concentrate went down the road by truck, by barge down lake, by truck to a railhead, and then by rail to Tacoma, where it was finally smelted. Here is a map of the valley and the site. That big black boundary is the boundary of the mountains, so that everything falling inside the black line winds up in Railroad Creek. Stuff falling outside goes someplace else. Here is a closer view of the, or a larger scale map of the site, showing certain site features. I have to get my fancy pointer here. The three tailings piles, this biggest, tallest one is the one that you usually see as you're driving in. We started calling them tailings piles 1, 2, and 3. Somewhere in the olden days, they had, there's some threesome from the Bible that these got named Meshach and Rorschach and that's, but we changed it a little bit. There are two big waste rock piles that I'll show you a picture of in just a minute. Waste rock is the material that when they first drilled into the mountain, they had to go through this rock that was junky. It wasn't of any economic value, and they just tucked that aside. And the way that most mine operations work is the main portal where you go into the mountain is right here. Miners, being the way they are, they throw crap the first place they can find it. And when that's filled up, they find the next place where they can throw stuff, and they fill that up, and then they find the next place where they can. When it got to the tailings piles, they did a little bit more work, a little bit more filling of tailings pile 1 before tailings pile 2 and 3, but after a while they were bumping back and forth between the three tailings piles. So it wasn't, this is the 1938 to 1942 pile, And then they filled this one and they filled this one. The stuff at the earliest stuff that was mined is at the bottom of this, but then they were going back and forth.
Before you change that?
Yes.
The name of the company, is that, what's Dames and Moore?
Dames and Moore. That's the...
I thought that was interesting. That's...
That was the engineering consulting firm that I started work with, started by Mr. Dames and Mr. Moore. But some other people have taken the same tack that Cliff has about every now and again some office would get a call saying, is this really Dames and Moore? That's a true story. Here's an aerial photo of like the one that we passed around yesterday. Here's the village. Village center, Koinonia. There's Cliff right there with his stapler. That's me. Okay. Here are those three tailings piles that we talked about. The two waste rock piles. And the mine entrance is right here. The mill building is, or the ruins of the mill building sit right there.
Where's the river? Do you have to cross the river to get to the mine?
Here's the river right here. And there is a footbridge right here and a car bridge right here. So there, and then there's another bridge right down here. So yes, you have to cross the creek, but you can do it on a bridge. Yes?
To get the pitch for this process of getting the material out of the original core?
Yeah. Yes.
Did they log before us around here, or where did they get the pitch?
I don't know very much about the makeup of that material other than it's, and I know they didn't log the forest. So I can't tell you very much. It's a pretty, I don't want to say exotic, but it's the formulation is kind of strange. So, but I don't know that there has ever been sustained logging here or severe logging. Okay. Everybody take a deep breath. Have a right brain moment. The fact that I get paid to work here is just stupid. Here's that classic U shape, so we know we're in a glacial valley. Here are two waste rock piles and the ruins of a mill building, so we know we're at a mine site.
Don?
Yes?
Were all these tailings, they were in a slurry form when they were put on the tailing pile?
Yes, they were.
Oh, okay.
Yes, they were slurried out in a pipe. If you walk up path, if you walk to the Portal Museum sometime, when you come back next time during the summer and it's open and Rick Dunning is there, you can see the wood stave pipe. It was, 2x6s wrapped in wire that they used, and that slurry was pooped out onto the tailings piles. And like I said, there was a drain in the center that the water drained out of, and the remaining material just settled and became part of the tailings pile.
Why can't they slurry it all back into the mine?
Because it's hard.
There are a couple of reasons for that. One is you can't get all the toothpaste back in the tube once you've squirted it out. And two, it would be very expensive. Three, some of the problems we have would still remain, which is now the water is going to continue to flow through that and it's going to come out the portal drainage. And so you're getting rid of some of the problem. You're not getting rid of all of it. It's really expensive, and you couldn't get all the tailings back in. They did refill. It's not a significant portion of the mine. It something like 10 or 15% of the mine was refilled with tailings as they were winding operations down. So they did that with some of them. Here we are on top of tailings pile number one, the one right across the creek from us, across the river from us. Looking up again at the two waste rock piles and the ruins of the mill building. We'll take a walk out to about that same place tomorrow. back in, when the mine shut down in 1957, they turned the power off. The mine the day before that had pumps down at the bottom that were keeping the mine dry. The mine started to refill in 1957. Somewhere in the mid-60s, no one's quite sure when precisely it happened, water had filled all the way back up to that main portal elevation and started flowing out. Soon after that, the main portal collapsed, so that when we came here in 1997, there were timbers and you could go in 10 or 15 feet, but then there was this big avalanche of rocks and mud that had water flowing out through it. We decided over time that sooner or later we would need to go inside the mine, both for scientific studies and probably for when we decide what we're going to do to fix it. It would help us to have that mine opening the way we wanted it rather than the jumbled mess that it was before. So we hired a set of miners, hard rock miners out of Idaho, who spent the summer, I think of 2000 here, reestablishing the main portal. So they went in, they mucked out all the bad stuff, put timbers in. The first thing they did was go down from above and start building a little alcove that they could work out of, and worked both ways, simply because there was so much really rubbly stuff right at the entrance. This is the work in the summer of 2000 with one of the miners. This is the LDH, which I forget what it means, but that's the load, dump, and haul, I think. This is a piece of mine equipment that could also be used in a coal mine to go do coal mining operation. In this case, they were hauling out the old railroad ties. At first, they were hauling out the muck. The first 90 feet back is glacial till material, which is all sizes from silt sizes to Volkswagen sizes. It's just horrific stuff to have to deal with. And then, after you get back into the mine about 150 feet, you get into the hard rock, and now you don't have to timber the entire way. About 100 feet in, we built a bulkhead and let the water pond up that was running out. The tunnel has a little bit of a slope to it, so that there's a pond behind this 4-foot bulkhead, but it gets shallower as you go further up the tunnel. We have a way to measure. This is a transducer which is hanging in the water behind here and measures the change in height of the pond. And by knowing that change in height and doing some math, we can figure out how much water is coming out.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I guess I don't really understand what the problem is, and why don't you just let nature take its course and reclaim it?
Excellent. That's an excellent question. And I'm thinking after we have a break in a few minutes and we talk for another 15 or 20 minutes, we'll get precisely to that point. This is me working.
That's something unusual, isn't it?
Hard hat.
What is a transducer?
A transducer changes one form of energy to another. In this case, it changes the difference in pressure to an electrical signal. So, yeah, that's me getting paid. Ain't it funny? If you hike back in, the way to get into the mine right now, if we let you get in the mine, would be to take one of the boats that we have and throw them over that first bulkhead and paddle up to the second bulkhead and throw the boat over the second bulkhead and paddle in another 1,000 feet. And then because the tunnel is sloping up towards you, you get on dry ground and now you can walk around inside the mine. And this was a photo that was taken probably in the summer of 2001 as part of the mine investigation. There have been two or three sorties into the mine. This is collapse feature, or this old collapse timbers. Here's what you look like when you go in the mine. Here is water falling down the old main shaft, falling probably some hundreds of feet. This is that you've finally made it back out of the mine safely, and now you're looking down valley from the top of one waste rock pile. This would be the western waste rock pile. This is tailings pile one. We're going to stand right here tomorrow. Tailings pile two, the big tall tailings pile, and the tailings pile three is hidden behind it because it's shorter.
So we already do see vegetation establishing itself on the tailings pile?
We see vegetation establishing itself on the tailings piles after the Forest Service did some work back in 89 or 90 to cap the tailings piles with gravel and to start the reseeding process. Prior to that time, people who have been coming here for a really long time might be able to tell us about the old days when the tailings piles were not capped. And when the wind would pick up, there'd be an orange cloud throughout the valley. So, another picture of the ruins of the mine building. We skipped past one picture. It's not important. This is a pond that we see in the springtime. The vehicle bridge is right, or the road is right here that the vehicle bridge comes on. If you walk out the main road here, and you don't take the footbridge and you go another not very far at all, tenth of a mile, you will come to a vehicle bridge. Here's the road coming back onto the other side. There's a pond here that forms in the spring here, where this is an obviously a spring photo. Here's water running off and collecting in the pond, and that greenish color to the pond is the copper. The way that mine levels were named here is the zero level, and this is for the two people who are interested, or if you find something out in the future that makes this important. The zero level is where the ore body intercepts the surface, so it's way up on top of the hill. The levels were identified by the number of vertical feet down from the zero level. So bigger numbers, when we talk about the mine levels, are deeper. The main portal is at the 1500 level, so it's 1500 feet down vertically from where the ore body outcrops. That was the main level, and the lowest level was 2675, so below Railroad Creek, below where we're standing right now. One of the reasons they needed to use the pumps. And here are small tailings piles that were associated with that early mining days and trace certain of the levels. The zero level is right about here where Holden shot the deer. This is about the 300 level, and there again, the 300, 700, 900, 1100, and then 1500, something like that.
Are there tunnels at all those levels then, is that it?
Yes, there are. And we're going to stop right now and have a 10-minute break. Please come back. Yes. This is tight ship. This is
this is all left brain, guys.
This is not that medical talk, so we've got to schedule it. See you in 10 minutes. Or I'm gonna start talking again in 10 minutes anyway.
Of all this.
What is the point of this?
You walk the stairs and
think that's the class. Based on the class, there's one there.
I'm gonna have to go up to.
This is my side.
Yeah, I can email a little bit.
Let's get around.
8 million tons.
Yeah.
The TSP, where I'm at, that's the beginning.
Oh, I see.
On the road.
All right, did you read that?
Is that the only one?
Yeah.
Sure, that'll, that, Cascade Road.
Is that considered pretty efficient?
S-K-N-E-T-T-L-E at copper.net. Gotcha. But I'll send you an email, then you've got my.
Material to work with.
I've got a lot of stuff that's stored.
I think that, from my understanding, this was a fairly well-run operation.
We get back on Sunday, we're around Monday, Tuesday.
There's still a Dames and Moore in San Francisco.
Dames and Moore has been assimilated into a larger company, so.
It won't be, I don't think I'm gonna be able to do it until.
Yeah, I think.
We have my work on that.
Confirm it anyway, to you, how's that sound? And you got my email. And then, but what I wanna do is that, I've got to find the words. I've got the CD. But somewhere I store it, it's moved from Western Washington to Central Washington. And my stuff is kind of screwed up. And so, I'm gonna get back, everything's gonna be reorganized, and I'm gonna move back to my office, I'll be very careful with all my stuff. And I'll find it, because that gets good, I'll see.
Well.
You gotta see the words. Breaking that goes in there. And, I'm trying to think of one singer. But Jesus, there's a tenor, and then there is a black voice. The guy who sings the black voice. And it just like.
What are you making?
What? What are you making?
I was.
Probably a scroll.
That's what I'm talking about, okay?
Oh, there you go.
It's really, but, wonder underwear for me, that's what,
Everything, like, the machine was not working yesterday, so I.
I'm guessing, yes.
Couple times.
And I went to the library, and lo and behold, I came across this particular container. It was in the,
Don, how much gravel do you have to put on?
And I said,
Healing theory.
And, put it on my seat.
They tried.
I said, wow. But this is the whole thing, it's a great stuff, it's a great song.
Gravel pit was down about where we get onto the switchback. Tomorrow, when we leave, there'll be a place where the bus driver will stop, put the brake on to make sure the brake works. If you look to the right, there's a road that goes down there, and that was where the gravel operation was.
That's what the bus driver remembers.
What reminder?
I got up at, I went to bed at 9:00, and I got up at.
Who do you work for?
I work for a company called URS Corporation, which took over Dames and Moore. It's a worldwide engineering consulting firm, 26,000.
26,000?
Oh, are they in the petroleum industry?
It's all consulting, a lot of transportation. Absolutely not.
And I've got three screens and shorts.
When you talk about some big problem or a little problem, is there copper here?
Yeah.
Yes. That's not a wizard. That's not a wizard. It's a big problem. Oh, what do you mean by a big problem? I would try to be as descriptive as I can.
Yes.
wasn't the side track.
The worst was the Yeah, absolutely. Yes, sir.
I was working a color hospital in Dorothy's last week.
Yes.
And there's a couple
Forest Service is the lead agency here because the majority of this is Forest Service property. Holden Village does not own Holden Village. Holden Village leases, or they, I guess they own the buildings, but the property belongs to the Forest Service. So Holden Village has a lease with the Forest Service. Holden Village owns 4 patented mining claims, but they cover just a little bit of ground on the other side of the creek, including the property that the mill building sits on. The Forest Service is the lead agency, but the Washington Department of Ecology is involved. That's the state EPA. The United States EPA is involved. The United States Department of Justice is involved because they get involved when there is a natural resource damage assessment claim. So when I go to a meeting on this project, that's who's sitting on the other side of the table. Forest Service, state EPA, federal EPA, Department of Justice, and the Forest Service has a consulting firm, a different consulting firm than URS. They're called Kirk Krauser, who do the technical work for that side of the table the way that my company does the technical work for our side of the table. So we have, when we have a meeting, it's a crowd at least this size. There are very few meetings where there's just a few people sitting around the table. And it goes up there from.
Oops,
that's okay.
I was trying to be discreet.
So we saw you sneaking in.
Marion being discreet, is that an oxymoron? And I don't mean that in a bad way. I really don't. All right, I'm gonna start the clock again going. Let's get back to work here. This is a laundry list of the early environmental investigations or actions that took place here, and I just want to point a couple of these out. First, when you see GW from now on, think groundwater. That's my shorthand for groundwater. So groundwater, both the portal, which is that pump, that little stream that comes out of the main, comes out of the portal itself. We call it the portal drainage, and the tailings piles. SW is surface water. Those things had iron, copper, zinc, and manganese, were elevated in Railroad Creek. They noted the absence of fish near the tailings piles, and they noted the absence of the aquatic insect fauna downstream of the tailings piles.
What's the insect fauna?
That's the variety of insects, the family of insects that we would see. It's the
right. Fauna is family?
I think, isn't that?
It's like flora and fauna. Flora would be the botanical word, and fauna is the animal world.
Well, that's what I thought, too. Should
okay.
Be a comma.
Excellent. Early environmental history. Did anything else in here happen around 89 to 91? Pacific Northwest Laboratories, PNL. These were hot. This was a group that was hired by the Forest Service. They built a diversion trench around the back of the tailings piles. That's what TP stands for. They put in riprap, which is big rock, at the base of the tailings piles because they were starting to worry about erosion of Railroad Creek into the tailings piles. And they put the gravel on top of the tailings piles. The specification was for that gravel to be 6 inches thick, excuse me. And so if you walk around up there, it's anywhere from not very much at all to perhaps a foot thick.
Did the gravel have to be brought in a great distance?
The gravel came from, they mined the gravel down. When we leave, there is a spot just before you get onto the switchbacks that the bus driver will stop the bus and put the brake on and hit the gas to make sure the brake works. Right about there, there's a road that dives off to the right, and it goes down to a place that was called Dan's Camp, which is where the gravel pit was. So they bucketed it there, and they screened it there to size sort it, and they put it on trucks, and they drove the trucks up the hill here.
Is there an equivalent energy of study and reclamation and environmental impact on the gravel pit, too? I mean, does everything you do here lead to more attempts to manage or restore the environment?
I think in that case, no, because the gravel pit itself, that operation would not have done anything on the chemistry side of things. And it's a sort of remote and small location.
Was that gravel deposited by the glacier then?
It was either it might have been deposited by the glacier and then reworked by Railroad Creek. It's off to the side of Railroad Creek. Okay, let's talk about the regulatory framework of the investigations here. This is not a Superfund site. If you've heard that somewhere or read it or heard it on the boat coming up, that was not true. The confusion is, well, first off, who are the players? We just ran through that list. There's both federal and state agencies. The Forest Service is the lead agency, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Washington Department of Ecology, which is the state EPA. Those are the agencies. They agreed with Intalco, which is the successor to Howe Sound Mining Company, to study the Holden Mine site under CERCLA and the State of Washington Model Toxic Control Act. Now, CERCLA is the Superfund law, so you can follow those laws but yet not be a Superfund site. To be listed as a Superfund site, you go through a separate process. But everyone said, hey, here's this set of laws out there that give us a framework for moving forward so we don't have to reinvent the wheel, so let's just go with the Superfund laws. The CERCLA process, or the Superfund process, like I said, it's a structured process that tells us what it is we need to do. There's an administrative order on consent. There's a legal agreement that says Intalco will, blah, 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 blah. The agencies will, blah, 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 blah. Someone will write a report. The report is due by 180 days after the start of field work. At that point, someone will have 90 days to review it. Anyway, that's the framework. The remedial investigation is, what? Let's figure out what the problems are. Once we figure out what the problems are, let's figure out how to fix them. That's called the feasibility study. In the end, there will be a record of decision, which is another legal document that says, we've decided these are the problems. We've decided this is how we're going to fix it. Within 180 days of the signing of the record of decision, Intalco will need to start work on remediation. And then there will be remedial activities, which is people out here with backhoes and moving stuff around. Schedule today. This is all, who cares about this? It's so long ago and we're so far behind schedule that it doesn't really matter. But at one point, in 2002, I thought these were the dates, and now here we are 4 years later. Remedial action construction begins. Spring of 2004. Are you nuts? Spring of 2006. No, we missed that one too. If right now, while we're here sitting around, everybody else on the project was in a meeting and had a big group hug and we decided that we were going to work together, it's going to be the spring of 2008 before we start those remedial activities. Because next summer we would have to come up and do some preliminary.
Are you behind because of poor planning, or what's the cause?
The process takes long. All processes take longer than you think they will. And we have gotten to a point where we are fairly at odds. So when you have a process that has 30 distinct steps in it, and each of those steps lags by a month, at the end of 30 steps, you're 2.5 years behind. Yeah.
So they built a new Dairy Queen in Minnesota, and they beat the goal. Why can't this happen?
Karen, go ahead.
It has to do with magnitude.
Is the main issue who's going to pay for it, or...
The main issue is the scope of the remediation. The client that I work for the last 2 years has been willing to start and spend approximately $40 million. The agencies have said that that will not be sufficient.
Can you give us a clue as to what the remediation action could be?
Yes. We'll talk about that, and whatever we don't get to today, mm-hmm. we will talk about on the fly tomorrow as we're walking around. So yes, we will not part ways without me having done everything I can to influence you. Go ahead.
Is this before the time of mining companies having to put up a bond before they started
yes.
the operation?
Yes. Okay. Remedial action construction begins. Spring 2000, we'll get there someday. I really hope we do. Okay, that's the end of this part. I need to start the second. These files get to be really big, so I had to split this into two bits. So any questions that I can try to avoid as well while...
Do you train your own replacement?
Yeah. Let me see.
Do I train my own replacement?
He's going to be retired.
In the jobs that I don't like doing, I'm excellent at that. So Have I done anything to train a replacement for this job at this location? Absolutely not. Have I done everything I can to backstab and push down the stairs and
push over the cliff?
Push over the cliff. No, I have worked, I have made efforts. The reason that I'm still involved in this project is because I've made efforts to stay involved in this project.
It's a passion for you.
There.
Yeah. Okay.
That's true.
That's true.
That both from a purely personal side of things. If there's anybody doing field work up here, I want the person doing field work up here to be me. And at the same time, if it were simply that, I would not have spent time on volunteer teaching staff or time with Elder Hostel. This is one of my favorite places on the planet. And I have since the fall of 1997, we were here for 6 weeks in the spring of 97, and we came back for 4 weeks in the fall. And I sat in the dining room with the project manager and said, you know, I know you can't promise me a job, but next year when we start fixing this place, I really want to be involved. And I have a picture in my mind of what can happen here if we do this right. And that thing can be a legacy to Dames and More, or URS, and Intalco, and for the next 50 years, college groups can come up here and study this and see the right things done. I won't ever do anything nearly as cool in my career again.
Yeah.
And by the same token, we could come up here and screw the pooch. We could do a bad job of it. And that would be known too. People would come up for the next 50 years and go, oh, they got two tin cans and a string. What the hell is this?
This is where Don dropped his shovel.
Well, exactly, as he walked away. So I feel very strongly about it, and what better place it cheeses me no end when I'm not up here doing work. And the fact that we're going to sit around a table for another year, and the fact that I'm more likely to be deposed now for a lawsuit on this thing than I am to be up here wearing blue jeans and a t-shirt, yeah, I'm upset about that.
What's the goal? I still don't know what the goal is with all this tailing piles.
Well, we're going to get there. It's going to take a while. First, we had to do a bunch of scientific studies. Here's the whole list while I've been blathering on. I hope you've been reading this because I don't want to spend any more time on it. We did a whole bunch of work. 6 weeks in the spring of 97, 4 weeks in the fall, 15 other studies since then. I've been up here a couple of different times installing new wells.
What was the bat survey?
Yeah, what's a bat survey?
A bat survey is some individuals at the Forest Service or on the regulatory side thought that the mine might be used as a batatorium, which is what you call a place where bats live. So we put sensors up in some of the portal openings to see if bats would fly by. We looked on the ground to see if there was any bat poop or bug bits that bats would have eaten. We came to believe that, no, this is not a batatorium.
This is too cold, isn't
it? Beats me. This is one of my friends out working. This is a well right here that's been drilled down into the ground that we're pumping water out of, that we're testing and we're going to collect samples of. This is another friend of mine. This is my buddy Jamie. He's an actual person, not make-believe. This is in the spring of 97. This is him sampling some seepwater. That's Railroad Creek there. This is at the base of tailings pile two. This is three consultants consulting.
Not drinking beer.
There's a computer doing some work right there that one of the guys is trying to turn his back on, and the other two people are talking. This is me working again, getting paid. This is me working, doing something different. The first time I was checking how much water was flowing down the stream. We know how wide the stream is. We know how fast it's flowing. We can figure out how much water is going down the stream. Now I'm collecting a water sample so that we can send it to the lab. This is a number of us fish shocking. This is how we figured out how many fish and how big the fish were. People here have a pole that looks like an old World War II minesweeper. It's got a little ring on the bottom of it with electric current going through it. They were waving those back and forth in the water, so when a fish would come near the current, it would get shocked, and we would dip it and collect it up with a net and put it in a bucket on the bank, and we weigh and measure the fish and take about 10% of them out and kill them and check their livers to see how much metal was in their liver and grind the rest of them up and see how much was in their tissue. Another one of the studies we did. This is guys inside the mine doing some more geologic study. There's a guy with a Brunton compass. This is a little drill rig right here on a barge down right next to, there's the lady cat right there, so you guys got on the boat right here. This is in the spring, or this is in the fall of 2001. We're going to bring that up the lake, and we're going to drive it up the road, and then we're going to drive it off the road, and we're going to drive it across the creek and park it and put in a monitoring well right here. This, ooh. That last picture was putting in the monitoring well in the rain. I don't want to think about that because it was cold. This is later up on top of the tailings piles. There's the back of the drill rig there. That's Copper Peak behind us. This was just before Thanksgiving of 2001. This is me working again, getting paid, doing a highly technical thing called pouring water in a hole. Which you might be able to do, but you can't get paid nearly as much as I can to pour water in a hole. In this case, what I'm doing is checking how permeable the material is. If you have really permeable material, you pour in buckets and buckets and buckets of water. And it goes out through the bottom of this casing, which is seated in the material that I'm trying to test. If it's not very permeable, you can only pour in water very slowly. So that's why they needed me to do it.
We have the same process going on in the sink in our room.
Okay. And you're not getting paid a bit for it, are you? I didn't think so. Okay, let's talk very generally. Let's take our basic geology level of thinking and apply it to the mine site. What's the site model? The site is located in a glacially carved U-shaped valley. We already knew that. The valley bottom and lower sidewalls are covered with soil and sediments of glacial origin. Some reworked by Railroad Creek. So the glacier came down, dumped its load, in places sat on its load and squished the heck out of it, so it's not very permeable, but then the glacier retreated, and now there's some river rock in there that's fairly permeable. So right here, where we're standing right now, down in the valley bottom, there's about 50 feet of permeable material with impermeable material below that. All site surface water and groundwater is ultimately discharged to Railroad Creek. So Railroad Creek is the drain for the entire valley. So everything that happens above, sooner or later, winds up in Railroad Creek.
Don, there's water that's below Railroad Creek, you know, down in the bottom of the mine.
Yes.
That's as much as 1,000 feet below or 1,500 feet below.
Yes.
Does that water have any connection to the creek, or does it just kind of sit there? Does it permeate anywhere?
Well. Does it have any connection? Yes. Does it have a very small connection? Yes. Is there a large connection? No. So, is
its connection just in that the fact that it's contiguous with water above and there's just...
And there have to be random fractures down there that would allow occasional pathways that get to the creek. But as you go in bedrock and you go deeper, the fractures get smaller and they get less frequent. So... So, hypothetically or theoretically, is there a pathway? Yes, there is. Is it very big? I don't think it's the case.
Thank you.
Yes, you bet. This is a geophysical cross section, and what this shows is this hatch pattern is the very dense rock that doesn't transmit water very well. And in this case, now I've got my groundwater guy hat on rather than my geology guy hat on. This rock or till, I don't care what it is, I know it doesn't transmit water. This stuff is the gravel that's sitting on top, and it does transmit water. So water that's coming off the slope here comes down the slope and flows into Railroad Creek, or turns and goes into the plane of the picture and starts to go down valley. So this is the world I care about from that line up. That's the world that can transmit groundwater. Below this, in Cliff's case, if there's a shaft in here, like I said, there may be a few fractures here at the top, but as they get deeper, they get skinnier and they get less frequent. So there may be a little bit of water transmitted along here, but not very much. And by the time you get down here, I don't think there's very much at all.
And all of our water that we're using?
All of our water that we're using comes from Copper Basin, which is way up behind the mine, and is we suck the water off before the mine ever gets to it.
What happens to the sewer stuff? You don't put that back in the creek, do you?
That goes to a leach field down the valley on the upstream side of the road. Okay, remedial investigation, key findings, site conditions. We did all of those, that whole laundry list of studies. We thought about it really hard. Here's what we came up with. There are two distinct groundwater chemistries at the site. If you take the footbridge, where we'll go tomorrow, if you haven't already been up there, and you look up valley from the footbridge, the groundwater has zinc and cadmium in it, but no iron. We'll talk more about that then. The water that comes out of the mine itself has that stuff in it, zinc and copper, excuse me, no iron. From the footbridge going down valley, you get more iron in the water, but you don't get that zinc and copper anymore. So there's a split. The second thing that we found was the spring runoff conditions in both volume, how much water comes off. Railroad Creek is 10 times the water in it on June 1st that it does today. And the chemistry are different. So if we did a bunch of sampling right now and looked at the chemistry and said, oh, that's what the conditions are, well, we're wrong. We're right for part of the year, but we're wrong for part of the year. Here is a hydrograph. This shows the amount of water flowing, running down Railroad Creek over a year. And so over the winter, this CFS is a cubic foot per second. It's just a unit of measure of how much water there is. We don't have to care about that very much, but we can look at the what the number, how it changes over the season. So less than 100 through the winter. And now it gets to be springtime and stuff starts to melt, and we get this jump up to 300 CFS, and then at high flow, almost 700 CFS. So seven times as much water on whatever date that is, say June 15th, as there is through the winter. It starts to drop off because all of the snow has melted off. Here, this is the snow that's right near Holden Village. This is the snow from up the valley. That starts to drop off. These are winter or summertime thunderstorms that we see reflected in the creek, and then we get to fall and things start to drop off. Why we get the different chemistry in the spring is because water flows through these surfaces that have been rusting essentially through the rest of the year. Rust is what happens to the tailings because they're iron. What's inside the mine is the same process, and it takes that, it makes almost a salt on the surfaces of the walls. And then in the springtime, you get this big flush of water coming through with the snowmelt, and it washes all that salt off and brings it down through the portal and puts it in the creek. So the dirtiest water that we get in the year is in the springtime. It's a little bit counterintuitive because you would think it would be the dilution effect of there being so much water, but it's not the case. Okay, before we were talking about the conditions that we had found, the site itself, the chemistry itself. Now we're talking about what did we find as far as potential environmental concerns to answer a question. We finally bloody got there. Okay, what are the problems? Seasonal exceedances of water quality criteria occur in surface water added near the site. These water quality criteria are... there are rules for us for drinking water, right? If you get water from a public water supply, it has to produce clean enough water. This is the same idea for fish. Discharge of the portal water and groundwater again from the western portion of the site lead to exceedances of water quality criteria in Railroad Creek at the site for cadmium, copper, lead, and zinc during spring runoff. That's important. It's important. It makes it sound better for us because it's only during the spring. It doesn't matter to the fish at all because the fish can't live in the creek for only 11 months out of the year, right? They got to be there the whole time. So cadmium, copper, lead, and zinc. One thing about zinc is we have a much greater tolerance for zinc than fish do. We can have 10 times as much zinc in our drinking water as a fish can have in the water it has to live in. Metals concentrations decrease as stream flow decreases, again, because we've washed off the walls of the mine particularly. By fall, those exceedances are limited to copper in one sample and zinc adjacent to and immediately downstream of the site. The other problem with zinc, besides it being real poisonous to the fish, is it's real mobile in the environment. Once you get it loose, it stays loose in its ionic form. Something like lead, even though it's more toxic, as soon as you bump a particle, a molecule of lead free, the next good space it finds, it hooks onto in the soil, so it doesn't travel very far. Zinc is the other way. Once it gets loose, it stays loose. Okay, other potential environmental concerns. This mirrors what the Forest Service found back way, what was it, the mid-60s? The benthic invertebrates, which are the bugs that the fish feed on, and fish populations are reduced downstream of the site. Fish populations approximately 3 miles downstream of the site are within the range of populations. So statistically, it's about the same. It's not precisely the same. 3 miles downstream from where we are above the mine. The benthic invertebrate populations are reduced all the way down to the mouth of Railroad Creek. That population hasn't reestablished once it gets cut. And this is fairly large. This is like a 90% reduction. It comes back some, but it doesn't come back very much all the way down to the mouth of the creek. The tailings pile slopes facing Railroad Creek are relatively stable under static conditions, but we've computer modeled and found that if we have a really big rainstorm and saturate the tailings, and then we have an earthquake, the top part of the tailings piles may just slide off and wind up in the creek. It's not very likely, but if it happens, it'll be bad. It'll dam up the creek, for one thing, and who knows how far the water will back up. I don't think that the water would back up far enough to flood the village, but now you've got this dam made out of tailings, which are bad, or I shouldn't say that, because somebody might be listening. They have some impacts to the environment. You got this big wad of tailings in the creek now, and sooner or later the creek is going to build up enough pressure that's going to blow the dam out and transport these tailings all the way down the creek. And now, cleaning up tailings out of the creek is going to be a heck of a task. Somebody with a little vacuum on their backpack, it'll be a Exxon Valdez kind of thing, where people will be going down the valley trying to suck up tailings. Go ahead.
What's the likelihood of there being a moderate earthquake?
Over the next 10,000 years, it's going to happen. What, no doubt about it. Sorry? Okay, 100,000.
Okay.
Then it's sure to happen. Over a million years, we're going to have a bunch of them.
Is there any evidence there have been earthquakes before that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there is.
Wait, does the water go to Lake Chelan then?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that lead and all that in Lake Chelan?
Not very much. No, by the time this water gets to Lake Chelan, it's been diluted by all of the influent streams as we go down valley, and then it gets dumped into Lake Chelan. This is the little kid peeing in the deep end of the pool. Mm-hmm. Sorry, but it's about right. Okay.
About a girl.
Okay, all right. Save that stuff for Cliff's class. Some surface and subsurface soils within the maintenance yard and lagoon area exceed regulatory criteria for some metals and total petroleum hydrocarbons. This is no different than any of 1,000 gas stations anywhere across the country. But the old, back in 1938, the old, what did you do in 1938, for those of you who were here then? When you changed the oil on your truck, you dumped it out back.